Okay, good evening, everyone. My name is Denisa Kostovicheva. I'm an associate professor in global politics at Department of Government and a member of the conflict research group that hosts this event. I would like to welcome you all to the LSE and to tonight's debate about state failure and state building. Our aim tonight will be to move this debate from the deadlock where it's been for several years now. And this deadlock has been marked by a Hamlet-like dilemma. This dilemma is to build failed states or not to build failed states. And whereas once external state building has been enthusiastically embraced in successive, if not quite successful, missions from Kosovo, Bosnia, Timor-Leste, Afghanistan, Iraq, after the exits from Afghanistan and Iraq, and come to crisis in Libya, the thought of post-intervention state building by external actors has not even been entertained. So in a way, in practice, in today's world, this Hamlet-like dilemma seems to have been resolved and the no camp has prevailed. But debate has been paralyzed, and it's been paralyzed by opposing arguments, irreconcilable positions around the issue of morality of outside intervention in the affairs of domestic states. And suffused by the discourse of neocolonialism, this debate has completely stopped being useful. And it has stopped being useful both in a sense of learning from the past and also in terms of pointing how the global community can contribute to a better and more peaceful world. So the publication of Professor Woodward's, can I say, Susan, long-awaited book?
Yes.
The Ideology of Failed States, Why Intervention Fails, is a significant contribution to this scholarship because it goes and tackles the fundamentals. It tackles and tracks the ideology of the concept of failed states and its consequences, and it offers an opportunity to break the conceptual theoretical deadlock, reframe the debate, and focus on effective policies to address the consequences of civil wars. And this is, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Professor Susan Woodward here tonight. Professor Susan Woodward is a professor of political science at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and her expertise rests on a career spanning policy and academia. She has more than 12 years policy experience, including in Brookings institutions in Washington. In the 1990s, she was the head of the Analysis and Assessment Unit in the Office of the Special Representative of the Secretary General for UNPROFOR. This was UN peacekeeping force in Croatia and Bosnia. Then she was also special advisor to the OSCE mission to Bosnia and Herzegovina. She created the initial research program on conflict security development for Department of International Development, DFID, here in the UK. And her academic career is equally impressive. She's held positions at Yale University and Northwestern University and has taught also at Georgetown, George Washington, and Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies. She's the author of two other widely acclaimed books, A Balkan Tragedy, Chaos and Dissolution After the Cold War, and The Socialist Unemployment, the Political Economy of Yugoslavia from 1945 to 1990. And she has written numerous other papers and articles on Southeastern Europe, post-communist transitions, state failure, peacekeeping, and post-conflict reconstruction. And also joining us tonight to spur the debate with her expertise on the issue is Dr. Christine Chang. She's a lecturer in war studies at King's College London, and her research on post-conflict transitions sits at the intersection of international relations and comparative politics. Her forthcoming book with Oxford University Press, on extra-legal groups explores how ex-combatants affect state building. Prior to joining King's College London, Christine was based at the University of Oxford, and her insights are also informed by her experience with the policy institutions, with Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, the UN Commission on Human Security, and the World Bank's on gender group. This is among others. Please join me in welcoming our speakers to LSE. Okay, so we'll proceed. Susan will speak for about 30 minutes or so, and then Christine will respond, which will leave us plenty of time for questions from you.
Thank you, Denise. I'm going to be lazy and sit. I hope you don't mind. So my book asks why the term failed states and its more diplomatic term, fragile states, but which to me means the same thing for its users, but which makes no sense empirically or theoretically, and does great harm politically. These are arguments in the book that I elaborate, so you'll just have to accept it on face value at the moment. Why the term persists, indeed, has become so common a part of our general discourse internationally that it would be foolish to try to stop it, I think. Instead, I focus on those who use the term and why, that is to say, international actors. I do want to warn you, however, that this story of one concept applies to many that we use casually, without thinking. And as scholars, students, academics who can analyze what the term means and what the consequences are of its usage, I think we have an obligation to do something about them. So in the case of failed fragile states, I begin by looking at its origins. Why and in what context did this term arise? This question is not only one of intellectual curiosity. The origins of this term have been critical in shaping actions under that rubric ever since. Contrary to those who assume it begins after 9/11, the attacks in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania, it begins in a fascinating debate to me about what should define the international system in both development and security after the Cold War. It is about an international transition and the opportunities for some and the need to adjust so as to survive for others. All of the arguments, and there are many of these actors are quite varied, all of the arguments zero in on the state. For those advocating an expansion of United Nations intervention and mandates, it's to give the UN authority to do transitional administrations where the authors assume that the local state is unable to do what is necessary to bring peace. This is already in the early 90s. For development donors, mainly the U.S. Agency for International Development in the actual argumentation in 94, but not only for USAID, it's to find a new rationale for development assistance among Western powers once their agreed anti-communist purpose has disappeared, so that USAID, in its case, is not eliminated. Senators at the time were saying, we don't need it anymore, let's get rid of development assistance. For security experts, it's to identify a new focus with the end of East-West rivalry, which they find or found then in internal wars, civil wars. For the World Bank and IMF, the focus on failed states, their term as well, is to focus on an explanation for an outcome of what they do not want to acknowledge, namely the failures of structural adjustment policies in the 1980s, to solve countries' debt crisis and to revive growth, such that by 1995, 80% of countries in serious debt arrears to the IFIs, that is to say they're not repaying their debts, and thus the institutional survival is even at stake for the World Bank and the IMF. We often forget that these two organizations are banks and they need to be repaid, are countries in conflict. President Wolfensohn comes on, the new president of World Bank in 1995. His staff tells them that's what the problem is of this arrears, and they set up a task force on failed states. The World Bank and the IMF argue that the cause of these internal wars and inability to repay their loans is not the policies that the two organizations had demanded in exchange for loans to these countries, but in their implementation. Hence, the problem lies again with states and political leaders. Or what the bank identifies in its normative model, I'm sure you've all heard it, good governance. For UNDP, the UN Development Program, or the Lithuanian group of Canada, Norway, Japan, and other like-minded states in the mid to late 90s, and for DFID under Clare Short, the first secretary at when the Labour government takes over and restores ODA to cabinet status, it is the opportunity to redefine security from state security to human security, and to reduce military expenditures in general with the end of the Cold War militarized rivalry. My second question, to try to explain the persistence of this concept, was to look at who uses it and why. So the first is its origins, under what context, then why. As I said, it really doesn't apply to the countries so-called, neither empirically, there are no cases, nor theoretically, all of the efforts to try and demonstrate the problem in these states that they are a security threat to the major northern wealthy states in the international system are all tautological in their analysis. In other words, the security threat doesn't exist. So we should focus away from what we call failed or fragile states to those actors who intervene in the domestic affairs of countries, development donors, UN peacebuilding and security actors, NATO militaries, the World Bank and IMF, and all of whom use the same term. I refer to this concept as an ideology because it is a set of unquestioned, self-evident assumptions that enable social action by these actors. The main components of this ideology are, first, a theory that these countries, and when I say these countries, by 2004 you begin to get indexes of failed or fragile states, and already within the first year there are 40 to 50 separate indexes. There are many more since. So the first lists of such states around 2004 comprise 40 to 50 odd countries. They quickly become all of what we called the Third World during the Cold War, and especially all of Africa in particular. And for the annual failed states index, all but 16 countries in the world they consider stable, like Finland. These countries, the theory is, these countries are the main threat to international peace and security, and thus to the security, as I said, of prosperous, stable countries, such as the US, the UK, most of Europe. This theory is simply not true. Second, in terms of this ideology, their definition as a security threat meant to these actors who use it that they represented a crisis and thus required among these intervening actors new capacities to act speedily and with flexibility, whether this is the UN, development donors of the World Bank and IMF, Western militaries. And because these countries were considered a security threat but were also poor, or that the actors engaged in this agenda and ideology were both development and security organizations, the ideology included the argument that security and development were intimately linked. This linkage is part of that self-evident, unexamined assumptions of the ideology. It is asserted all the time, but never really explained. Finally, because the problem was these countries' states, weak, fragile, failing, failed, all the adjectives we use, the solution, which they all asserted, but which meant very different substance for each of them, is state building. The research literature on these state-building interventions, which is a vast, concerted international effort to save, fix, repair, the verbs are always used in titles, and to build states since 1991-92, is almost uniformly critical of results. Whether one consults a large literature of empirical research on cases by scholars, or the monitoring reports and operational evaluations by the state-building organizations themselves, there is a common assessment that state-building policies, as currently practiced, actually undermine the state, making it weaker than it was or than it would have been if left alone. In some cases, such as Somalia and Haiti for two decades, Afghanistan since April 2002, or the Democratic Republic of Congo since November 1999, state failure in this critical literature has even been explained as a consequence of international state-building interventions. There are many proposed explanations for these outcomes. If the problem of failed states is their presumed consequences, refugee flows, terrorism, and so forth, there's a long list, Stuart Patrick argues, then state building's the wrong remedy. Policy should address each of these consequences directly. Others criticize interveners' normative model of the state, what is often called in this literature a Western Weberian model that only applies in Western Europe historically, and the goals of so-called liberal internationalism to guide interventions that are, in fact, inappropriate to these countries' conditions and needs. A third strand of explanation focuses on the neo-imperialist or neo-colonialist approach to state building, which cannot succeed, the criticism goes, because the policies are imposed, particularly if the goal includes democracy. This approach even creates new political instability and sources of conflict when, as is common, it is also blind to local power structures on the faulty assumption by international actors of a tabula rasa when they arrive. Mark Duffield, David Chandler, and Simon Chesterman each separately argue the opposite. What Duffield calls the liberal dilemma, and Chandler empire in denial, that liberal values prevent northern actors from intervening directly as success would require, despite their good intentions. As Chesterman succinctly summarizes in regard to transitional administrations, quote, the problem is not that transitional administration is colonial in character, rather, the problem is that it sometimes is not colonial enough, unquote. Finally, what Jonathan Goodhand and Mark Cedric call, quote unquote, technocratic formalisms, can easily lead, they argue, to isomorphic mimicry. Or as Lance Richard and Devire argue, quote, it is much easier to create an organization that looks like a police force with all the de jure forms such as organizational charts, ranks, uniforms, buildings, weapons, than it is to create an organization with the de facto function of enforcing the law, unquote. All of these explanations are plausible. I'm perfectly happy to accept all of them. But with illustrations from Afghanistan, Cambodia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina, I propose instead that the explanation is that international state-building activities are not focused at all on local actors and institutions in the target state. The goal of so-called capacity building, on which all agree, whatever each organization specifically means by that, and means many things, is on building their own capacity for state building and related interventions. One might even think about their behavior as a type of state formation for international organizations and bilateral ministries and bureaus, building institutional capacity for state building, as I detail in great length in the book. Actionable legitimations, building of policy frameworks, new offices, capacities for coordination and policy coherence among all of them, new standing national and international staff, new budgets, all for the intervening actors not for the states. Perhaps the most convincing of what they are actually doing, rather than saying, lies in the data on resource flows of how very little goes to the countries themselves. At best, 19% of what is called the country programmable aid by aid scholars, and that's for all of these countries, most of the world, and nothing to local producers. Almost 70% on what is of aid goes to what is called technical assistance, 70%, which means outsiders, usually from donor countries, who are paid high salaries and benefits to give advice within countries, within government ministries and similar. My favorite way of thinking about this problem is from Ole Jakob Sending, that locals are never called experts. Only outsiders are experts. For post-conflict countries and African countries, this 19% of aid money that remains within the country is even smaller, at most 11%. There is a second reason, I argue, why these state-building interventions do not succeed. That is to say that these actors are not doing state-building. The solution they claim does not mean they're doing nothing. In fact, the term failed fragile states, I argue, is a camouflage for these actors who use it as well as for us, for a very real set of problems for them, namely that these countries, the ones they call failed or fragile, do not have the three characteristics that these actors need in order to achieve their own organizational mandates and operating procedures. The first is sovereign consent. All of you know that that the norm of sovereignty means that governments must invite people in, and who's going to give it in most of these circumstances. Political will, which is the language used by these actors, and thus people they call sovereign interlocutors, partners to work with in the country, who agree with these actors' policies and programs and therefore cooperate. And third, administrative capacities that enable these actors to act. In the book, I emphasize that we talk about sovereignty as a normative constraint on intervention, whether one can, under what conditions can one intervene, whereas in fact it's an operational constraint, what one needs to intervene. Beyond that, however, is these actors' goals. Once one looks at what they say, the definition of failed or fragile states becomes countries unable to, and now I'm quoting from policy documents, to use international resources effectively, and quote, countries difficult to assist, unquote. For the OECD Development Assistance Committee, the organization of all of the Western Northern donors, there are 23, it is, quote, difficult environments. For DFID, the Development International Development Department in the UK, difficult partnerships. As a person representing the OECD Development Assistance Committee said at a meeting in Madrid I attended, quote, fragile states are environments where international agencies cannot use their preferred aid effectiveness modalities, unquote. For some, like the U.S., this is even narrower. The need for effective public finance management systems along the American model to reduce what the U.S. calls the fiduciary risk of giving aid. There are even now websites providing countries, recipient countries, with platforms for what is called aid management. Let me quote from a UN report on Haiti, just to give you a sense. The UN Ad Hoc Advisory Group on Haiti recommended in 1999, quote, the long-term development program of support for Haiti addresses the issues of capacity building of government institutions, especially in areas such as governance, the promotion of human rights, the administration of justice, the electoral system, law enforcement, police training, and other areas of social and economic development which, it adds, are critical for enabling the Haitian government to adequately and effectively coordinate, manage, absorb, and utilize international assistance and development aid. Nothing much there about what the Haitian government says it wants. These organizations' solutions to these three operational constraints and requirements of intervention, as I detail in very great length, so if you're interested, I recommend Chapter 7, are many, most of which, however, are state-avoiding, parallel mechanisms. Failed or fragile states are ones that outsiders don't trust. So you don't go through the state. You find other ways to do it yourself. What matters for us at this moment, though I encourage you to read the details, is that they have disastrous consequences for these countries being aided. First, they are all piecemeal projects, largely, according to the needs and interests of each intervening actor. And second, they reinforce, or more often even create, the very characteristics that these actors associate with failed or fragile states. I focus this discussion on two goals that the outsiders, especially development donors, more than security, articulate. They want accountable and legitimate states, and they want governmental capacity and effectiveness. I then will add two consequences that I see and consider extremely important for this category of countries, especially as those who use the concept of failed fragile states focus the incoherent states they produce and their promotion of conflict. So first, accountable and legitimate states. Despite these outsiders' rhetoric, accountability is expected to and measured by outsiders' demands and interests. I even labeled their goal as, quote, internationally responsible states. So anytime you hear about legitimacy as if it's domestic legitimacy, think otherwise. So in other words, not the accountability of governments to their citizens, as this term would imply. Second, while locals say very strongly, and not only in immediate post-conflict cases, but also places like Haiti, that they need time to develop a sense of national identity, community, and legitimacy at home, and they, all of them, from Haiti to East Timor to Liberia, have very clear ideas about how to do this, outsiders insist that speed in getting a national development strategy, defined, of course, again by the same outsiders, that donors can support for a donors' conference, matters more and must be done immediately. Locals' requests for this temporal space, especially after war, but not only, take too long, they say. Third, particularly striking of outsiders' actions is the emphasis on secrecy, behind-closed-door negotiations, exclusiveness in whom they talk to, emphasizing the executive branch of government, and even then mainly the Ministry of Finance and perhaps the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And despite the rhetoric of many of them, preventing participation in the policies and aid that are being adopted by members of parliament, therefore political parties, civil society, other NGOs, especially women's groups, and even the outsiders recoiling from any public debate. And thus, by limiting information available to citizens, organizations, and so forth, which is, after all, necessary to both effective government and genuine democratic participation, these actors further weaken democratic structures. Second, although outsiders complain about the lack of leadership in fragile states and these countries' inability to plan, if one looks at the extraordinary volatility in aid, its fragmentation, and the long delays in disbursement of committed funds, you'll need to look at the data in my book to see how serious this is, one can see how planning by local governments is nearly impossible by even the most talented and educated political local leaders. Data on the number of daily aid missions and paperwork requirements are mind-boggling in terms of the overload on government officials as well. The transaction costs for locals are really almost unimaginable. Actual interventions such as UN or NATO peace missions also poach the best educated and talented locals for their own staff, with higher salaries that no local government can pay and thus hope to attract so they can't build up the civil services that are needed, but also in positions like chauffeurs that quickly de-skill the people who the outsiders are employing. Then, whether for simple governance or for serious economic development, we know that policy coherence and sectoral and geographic interlinkages, those of you who are scholars of development economics know how the interlinkages are essential. Integration and interlinkages are essential. Donor actions instead, however, are highly fragmented, both sectorally, sector, health, education, infrastructure, rule of law, and so forth, and geographically within the country. Indeed, the poorer the country, the greater the fragmentation of aid. You would want it to be the opposite in terms of capacity. For example, even 3 years before independence, there were 28 donors operating in South Sudan, with 376 projects, of which 66 were bilateral. So that requires politicians to arrange. In Cambodia by 2008, long after the peace agreement, there were 39 multilateral and bilateral donors, more than 1,300 separate projects, around 1,000 project implementing units. These are prescribed by the World Bank, with piles of instructions, steering committees and standalone working groups for these agencies, and more than 400 donor missions, reviews, and studies conducted each year. This is just Cambodia. In aid-dependent Mali, there were 40 donors. In Mozambique in 2005, 43 separate donor offices. In Afghanistan, 2005 to 2010, 67 countries and external organizations had field offices in the country. In Macedonia and Albania, more than 45 different organizational actors were engaged in police reform alone. I want to quote on Haiti. This is a bit long, but I hope you'll see that this is now in terms of the World Bank towards Haiti. The World Bank required extensive planning before extending loans and grants. Then, once approved, required even more reporting, accounting, and evaluation. The more World Bank programs a country participated in, the more planning, reporting, accounting, and evaluation was required. Because each program was highly specialized, countries must assign expert staff. As donors added more specialization to the aid portfolio, country staff must then coordinate with one another, often across ministries. Pretty soon, Haiti needed a larger aid administration staff to match the donors. Just in the past few years, this is a report by the U.S. National Academy of Public Administration. If you're interested in Haiti, I recommend it highly, which was written in 2006. Just in the past few years since aid was restored, the World Bank and Haitian government produced or are producing 15 major documents. The IFC, the International Finance Corporation, which gives cheap loans from the World Bank to countries, now underway involved 26 bilateral and multilateral organizations employing 250 experts and required 6 months to complete. I'm sure you know the size of Haiti. Overload in terms of demands on officials' time. Remember, this is a critique that they don't do planning and have capacity. Overload in terms of demands on officials' time is particularly striking to me. In Vietnam alone, a country that is better able to manage such attention than the most, has a very effective government and highly centralized. In 2007, there were 752 donor missions, more than three missions a working day. In Uganda in 2003, according to a report they submitted to the OECD Development Assistance Committee monitoring program, the Ministry of Finance was faced with what the Ugandans call hosting five missions at the same time. Who, and now I quote the Ugandan government's report, by talking to different people about the same thing, they attempted to play one official off against another to get the government to buy in to a particular approach of each donor in a piecemeal way. Imagine external efforts to build rule of law, one of those international objectives, when the UN focuses almost entirely on human rights monitoring and training. Development donor monies for police reform tend to go for seminars, trainers, and uniforms without the infrastructure necessary, like vehicle and communications. Hard to be an effective police without them. The World Bank and the U.S. Congress refuse to fund police programs. Externally funded programs are designed according to the national traditions of the donor country. For example, in Afghanistan, the U.S. for military reform, the Germans for police training, the Japanese for demilitarization, the Italians for judicial reform and an Italian-based criminal code, the U.K. for counter-narcotics. Police reform alone in Southeast Europe, as I mentioned, the large number, involves three international organizations: the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe, the European Union, and a U.S. agency of the Department of Justice, ICTAP. As for the U.N., each of which involved multiple agencies in this police reform, for example, CIVPOL, UNDP, UNHCR, UNODC, UNICEF, and WHO. Then there were also, on the same police reform, separate national missions from Australia, Germany, Italy, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, France, Denmark, Greece, the UK, Europol, Interpol, Austria, and the Czech Republic. But then also that's sectoral fragmentation. Most efforts as well from these UN or NATO missions are focused only on the capital city, leaving the rest of the country to itself. Or if some of these actors do extend outwards geographically, each actor takes a different area, again fragmenting the result. The community development programs in Mozambique will run each one by different organizations, Sweden, UNDP, US, UK, for each province within Mozambique. Finally, there is much evidence that these international actors, many of whom say their focus is conflict prevention or conflict termination, actually lay the basis of new conflicts, such as emphasizing speed on issues that take time, as I already mentioned, by interrupting also local political processes. My Haitian colleagues are very clear about how every time they'd get something going, there'd be another intervention. Supporting the consolidation of exclusionary regimes. A student of mine shows this especially well in Tajikistan. Insisting on what I would call revolutionary change, that is top-down rapid, in terms of gender and human rights, without regard to traditional bases of authority at all, one would want to work with them, and refusing to recognize existence of differences of opinion. For these outsiders, I had on Monday an IMF, retired IMF person who illustrated this perfectly. There's only one correct way. And the local problem, outsiders say, is that they have not yet formed a consensus that the outsiders need. I don't know how much of you think about what democracy is supposed to be about. I will conclude by returning to my focus on origins. Why do we get this term? Why does it succeed in what I call a battle over concepts and efforts to redefine the international system after the end of the Cold War? In what ways did it lead to changes in the international system after 1991? If we take the ideology about failed states seriously, and now I mean its argument about the strong linkage between security and development, it's important to notice that no change took place in the international order after 1991 in ways that the other concepts that were competing with this one were proposing, and especially that organizations focusing on development like the World Bank or DFID or UAD, and organizations focusing on security, UN peace missions, NATO, U.S. counterterrorism, and so forth, remained completely separate as they had been since 1944, 1945. How can you have a linkage if the organizations are separate? But that argument of linkage is important to pursue. As I end the book with case studies from Liberia in terms of its inability to face the Ebola crisis because of what the U.S. had done on security, namely build a professional army that wasn't really what I think Liberia needed, but not health care. And Yemen, in terms of the current horrors, it's just too tragic to tell you about now, but I recommend you reading those pages of Chapter 8. And even worse than when I finished this book, because the conditions of these development and security actors on the countries they're supposedly aiding, where forms of intervention and aid take place, are more often than not in serious conflict and contradiction. What they're expected to do by the development actors and by the security actors are literally in conflict. But it's left then to these countries to manage this contradiction, which I will say in the few cases I know is really impossible. So I want to say that if there is going to be positive change for these countries that are so labeled, it will have to take place at the international level where it began, in 1991 to 95. Some will say, in fact have said, that I'm arguing against any intervention, any development aid, any UN peacekeeping. This would be totally wrong. But we do need to take seriously, I think, the mistakes we are making and how we still need to rethink the international system, which after all is what produced what we have, the profound rethink that did happen in 1944-45 because of the Great Depression and World War II. So my last question, why not again?
Thank you very much, Susan.
Christine.
Thank you, Susan. That was wonderful.
Thanks, Christine.
So, first of all, I want to say one thing, and that is thank you for writing this book. And I say that coming from a place of both policy and as a researcher, and I've been thinking about these topics for about 15, 20 years now. And in fact, one of the first people I would say who has inspired me to do this was Susan herself. I came over to her house for tea, I think as a PhD student, about 15 years ago. And I don't think she knew me from a fly on the wall, frankly. But she invited me into her house anyway, so I wanted to say thank you for that. But more importantly, the thank you comes from a place of only a scholar can write this kind of a book, right? So if you, hopefully you will have the chance to read this book. But it is provocative, and I mean that in the best kind of way. It says things that I think anybody in the policy world or in the think tank world, or frankly a lot of academics, just can't say or don't have the guts to say. And you can disagree with a lot of it or agree with all of it, but there is a space for academics to be able to speak truth to power, even if that truth is deeply unpleasant and deeply critical, but deeply self-aware in many ways. So I wanted to start off by saying that I think it's hugely provocative. The arguments are going to inflame a lot of people, especially in the West, but I think there's a place for this kind of scholarship, and I think there's a place to think very deeply about the critiques that Susan is trying to put forward and to put them front and center, especially in light of what has happened in the past decade with Afghanistan, with Iraq, with our approach to Syria and Libya and other places in the Middle East, and frankly, many other places around the world for, you know, at least the past 50 years. There are a lot of hard questions being asked here. So, you know, take the rest of my comments that will come in light of what that first thank you. So I think many of the positive things that have come out of this, the first would be, I would say, that Susan is trying to look at a structural question, right? Not just saying, look, here is a problem of how, you know, the peace-building literature typically says, you know, here's a problem and looks at the question very internally and says these are the problems that are internal to the country, and that is part of this critique, right? But, of course, it fails to zoom out a little bit and say, you know what, these problems are actually caused by many of the interveners themselves, and I think that is a core point that she's trying to make here. But the literature, broadly, doesn't zoom out very often. We sort of say, oh, you know what, Sierra Leone and what has happened there, yes, structural adjustment was part of it. But no, actually, structural adjustment, a lot of people who look at Sierra Leone deeply would say maybe one of the three or four key factors that led to the civil war there was IMF structural readjustment, for example, right? And there are lots of examples like this. And I think this idea of zooming out and thinking about where our responsibilities lie as Western actors, you know, that is a key part of critiquing ourselves. I was pointed to this idea in a very sharp way in class, actually, on Monday, when one of my students, who's from India, said to me, you know, Shashi Tharoor, who almost became UN Secretary General in the last round, there's a talk by him, and he reminded us that India, before colonialism, had 33% of the world's GDP. I was quite shocked by that. I didn't know that before he raised it. And he said, after colonialism, well, you know, everything changed. So, you know, nobody has held, for example, the UK to account for colonialism, I would say. And I don't think the UK itself has looked at its own past and thought deeply about the responsibilities that it's had. So, you know, I think these structural critiques are really, really powerful and important. And I would say that if there would be one thing to add to the discussion, it would be to go more deeply into some of those issues around colonialism. I absolutely agree with many of the critiques on the quantitative side of thinking about failed states and the failed states index. I have my students do an exercise every year to try and recreate the numbers for one or, you know, for four countries for the FSI. And, you know, it's to show how flawed and subjective and how random a lot of these numbers are. They feel like they're picked out of thin air, and you can, you know, there are a million ways to think about the migration issue, for example. This is one dimension of the FSI, and you can break it down many different ways. And the way in which you choose to give a country a 4, a 5, a 6, a 7, a 10, you know, it depends on what you decide to emphasize, right? So if you look at Nigeria, one year you think about Boko Haram and things look really, really bad. The next year, Boko Haram isn't in the news anymore, and we forget about the girls that have been kidnapped, and that number then actually drops down to a 6 instead of a 9, right? But the situation on the ground has not really changed, and I would say that's absolutely part of the critique that Susan is trying to offer. So, you know, there is this bigger, broader consideration of what is going on the ground when we talk about failed states and what that actually means in practice, right? The interveners that are doing this work are doing it often from their desks, and there is a great disjuncture between the people who are in the field, on the ground, and then trying to mediate with UN or DC or London or Paris headquarters and trying to negotiate how that policy looks like and the operationalization of it, and then what it looks like on paper, right? And I think if you get the chance, you know, Susan's got this tale of the Mali case, and she talks about how, you know, donors are actually trying to do something good here in focusing on incentives-based ways of evaluating outcomes, right? So what they're trying to do is come up with a way to actually make the countries care about the things that are going to lead to results on the ground. So they're trying very hard to do this, and they're working with the Malian government. And then in the end, you know, you end up with 88 indicators, only 22 of which actually end up focusing on a results-based kind of effectiveness measure, right? So effectively, the other 66 are meaningless and don't have any kind of impact. And so it becomes very easy to disguise what looks like success. And I think the rhetoric around these issues and the ways in which they can be instrumentalized for donors, either as, you know, UN officers trying to keep their jobs on the ground, NGO actors who are interested in their own self-survival and the existence of their institution, frankly, you know, to DDR and SSR experts and private sector actors who are interested in making a buck. You know, all of these play into the failed state ideology that I think Susan is trying to put forward. Okay, so those are just some of the many things that I absolutely agree with. I think if I was to, I'm going to offer some comments that I think should be thought of as broadly, let's think about this. You know, so I don't totally agree with some of the issues around tone, right? I think there's a deep critique here that is absolutely legitimate, and I agree with a lot of it. But I think that there's more deliberation and strategy implied by Susan than I would actually give credit to. I would say a lot of the time, what I see on the ground, we can look at as it comes out looking like it's a deliberate strategy, and I find it's often a matter of incompetence, actually. That people don't really know what they're doing, and they rely on frameworks that they're familiar with, or they try and make things work within the constraints that they have. And in fact, incompetence actually ends up explaining a fair bit of what is going on, rather than a deliberate idea of trying to harm. That's too strong. It's not trying to harm, but the argument about something that is ideological, which I think implies more deliberation, I think gives them actually too much credit. And I think there's not enough organization to get to the point where I would say that it would be an ideology. I think also that ideology requires some form of consciousness, and I'm not sure that there is that kind of consciousness there. So if I was to say anything, I would say it's more an ideology of stateness, that people have this. And I write about this in my book, right, that people really believe deeply in states. And I think Western actors in particular believe strongly in states. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this myself, because that I think I came at these issues in exactly the same way, and I have done pretty much a 180 in the past 15 years on all of these issues. And I came to that about, though, starting from the point of the state is good, right, that because most of us and most interveners come from a place where the state works and you expect it to work and it has always worked and the state does good, then you take that idea and then you take it to other places and you assume that the same that is true at home can also be applied overseas, forgetting, of course, that it took hundreds or perhaps a thousand or thousands of years to get to the point where we can have these kinds of conversations, where I can critique, you know, Theresa May or Donald Trump or Justin Trudeau without fear of being jailed, right? So it took a long time to build up rule of law and constitutions and democracies and so on, and to be able to have civil discourse. And there are all sorts of norms, you know, just regular everyday discourse, media, freedom of press, so on and so forth, that allow all of that to happen, that undergird the structure of what we think of as being formal institutions. So, you know, I would just say that some of those issues I feel are more sociological from the individual state builders' perspectives and are not so much ideology as much as kind of, you know, a mix of mistake of practice and, you know, just trying to muddle through and do your best, as the Brits would say. I think that, I guess the only last thing I maybe want to say is about Liberia, which is a case that I know fairly well. I think that there, you know, you make that point so beautifully at the end. You say, you know, there was so much money. There were billions, at least $1 billion a year spent every year since 2003 on Liberia. And what the hell did that money get end up being spent on? You know, and I think so the most awful case in point was when there was the first case of Ebola that was reported in the United States, and then immediately, you know, a ton of funding was thrown at Liberia, and they built a state-of-the-art hospital. And that's not what the country needed at all at the time, right? So they spent, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars on this hospital that had 300 beds, and I think that ended up treating 3 Ebola patients or 13 Ebola patients. It was something ridiculous, and the whole event had actually finished. You know, the crisis had pretty much wrapped up by that point, and that was how all of the money, you know, a good chunk of that budget was spent. And I think that really characterizes, you know, our failure to examine what it is that we're doing. At the end of the day, I agree that we are spending a lot of the money on our own capacity, and that is hidden by the big numbers, by the number headlines at the top. So when you look, I mean, one of my personal objections, and has always been an objection to the 0.7% aid number, is that I think that money doesn't actually end up getting spent on aid, right? It doesn't end up being spent on the people that you think, that the voters think that money is actually being spent on. It is, a lot of it is spent on Western actors and development in the ways that help Western institutions and NGOs and think tanks and so on and so forth, right? That it's not, a lot of this is an illusion, and I think Susan has done us a huge service by really trying to shatter that illusion. So thank you very much, Susan. I think you've written something remarkable, and I hope everybody in this room will have the chance to read it.
You know, it's really not fair to have a colleague comment because all these compliments are so nice. but I do want to thank you. There are two comments that you made, Christine, that I'd like to address. And the reason is I'm getting them from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So it's really quite fascinating. The first is, isn't this just a new form of neo-imperialism? The pattern is so colonial. You mentioned Shashi Tharoor's current recent book and critique, though it came out in this lecture that he's getting criticized for by reviewers. And I still think it's not colonialism because it's each individual actor rather than the states. They're not there to extract the way a colonial state was. And to say that a rule of law department in the UN and the police reform one or judicial reform in the Department of Justice in the U.S., they're different kinds of actors. So we may have to think about intervention differently than I imply and perhaps mislead in terms of the title. But the other reason I don't yet accept this sort of colonial neo-imperial idea is that I think, you remember I gave you many of the explanations for why state building doesn't succeed. And one or two of them in that list I gave you are people who say it's neocolonial. Just not neocolonial enough, or the Chandler Duffield stuff that the neocolonialism is there, but it's harmed by its liberal commitments. And I think I'm saying something more. But because everybody's saying this, I have to take it quite seriously. The other thing is that, and I'm getting criticism too for using the word ideology. Mm. And I will tell you that I use the word ideology from the work of an American historian of 16th and 17th century England, a time when merchants are beginning to get involved in international trade. They know they want something out of policies of government, but nothing's coming and gelling. And she, with lots of documentary evidence, shows that once they got an idea of a market and then what that means in terms of an economic system, they could begin to organize among each other and pressure for certain policies. And so that's what I mean by ideology. I don't mean anything explicit at all. I think when I say that ideology, in the sense of the failed states, is unexamined assumptions, I don't think the actors themselves, when they use it, are aware that they are doing what I think is using an ideology that guides them. So I don't think it's strategic or deliberate, nor could their behavior, these actors' behavior on the ground, be deliberate or strategic, because they're each working from within their organizational mandates or even their bureaus within their organization. But I'm not so sure about incompetence. I mean, we do know, those of us in the room, and Christine and I are in that group, and some of my other friends here, that complaints from countries that are received, shall we say, a peace implementation mission after a ceasefire or a peace agreement, I think particularly of Bosnia and Kosovo in terms of these complaints, and Denisa can reaffirm, it really makes them quite angry that the people who are in these missions and telling them what to do are 23, 24-year-old people who really don't know very much, certainly not about the country they're there, and getting huge salaries. So that's the one way in which I think one could identify aspects of incompetence. Not that they're aware of it. I think most of them are sincere. But I think these, you know, each organization is quite, they're planning what their projects are going to be. We could talk about of that. Now, so whether it's an ideology of stateness, I have to think about that, about the state being good. I think in my empirical material and people, the organizations and actors I'm looking at, it's just that they need the state. But in very specific ways. You remember I start the last chapter saying, in fact, I wonder if you could I read one paragraph to show.
Is it the quote at the beginning?
Yeah. So the last chapter says, with what I've already told you. But then I say, who would not sympathize with a national public radio, that's a United States, U.S.-wide public radio station, journalist reporting from Syrian refugee camps in January 2015, in the midst of the harshest winter in decades, and perhaps the most brutal civil war and refugee crisis anywhere since World War II. When she exclaimed in frustration, she was just reporting as a journalist from the camps, "What we need is a stable state," is what she says. Surely people living in countries that outsiders identify as failed, fragile, or conflict-affected would agree. One cannot have security or economic development, especially the income-earning employment that matters most to ordinary people, without states. Even philosophically, the very legitimacy of the modern state, from Hobbes to Foucault, is based on its promise of protection and well-being for its citizens, however much this promise, as Joel Migdal tells us, is only a projected image. But it does not reflect its actual practices. So I go on, but I think that all of us would like states to do what we think they should do, but of course my book is about how what we outsiders expect from them is not necessarily, in fact, hardly ever what the locals really at that moment want. That gets a little complicated, but that we're making things worse in terms of what we say is good about the state in the way in which we intervene.
Oh, great. Well, this gives us a taste of what a debate this is going to cause. Mm-hmm. Okay, so please ask questions. We have Stuart. So I'll take three at a time. I'll remember who you are, okay? So we'll have the gentleman here, the lady there, and we'll go over there to the gentleman there, okay? Please introduce yourself first.
Thank you. My name is Patrick Schumach. I'm an architect working globally. And I find the fascinating talk. I will certainly read the book. I think it's obviously depressing and tragic. And at the same time, I think that's what it is. And I just wanted to see where you find hope. For me, it's in the tradition of maybe somebody, a Peter Bauer, exposing the false logic and incentive structures and making a whole kind of enterprise of foreign aid a hopeless venture and needs to be totally undercut. And I see it similarly. So I wonder where you draw your conclusions. Do you think that this critique would shake up things, or are there just logics at play which are self-serving in their structural patterns, whether this critique will fall back on deaf ears, because we have heard these similar kind of critiques before to some extent. Let's say Peter Bauer, this is nearly 40, 50 years ago. And we have maybe the brightest and best motivated and smartest people. We have all the rhetorics in place of evidence-based and measures and critiques and counter-critiques and accountability structures in the nth degree, because all this is driven from these super sophisticated accountability structures which took 100 years to build. I've become a huge skeptic, and I much more trust development through markets and business. And I think the Chinese entering with a hard-nosed business mentality into Africa as the first signs of real development. So I think what's missing is real feedback. For me, if I've come to realize, it can only be a profit and loss signaling. And I don't trust. And for me, this is the machinery which consumes, yeah, not extracts, but consumes all the subsidy monies which flow in and the donation monies which flow in. And that's what kind of churned. And you say they're doing more a net negative, more harm than benefit. So isn't the conclusion to shut all this down?
Okay, thank
Switch
you.
Switch it off.
We had the question there. Shall we take three questions, Susan, and then...
Hi, Frances Ryan. Has there been a case where it has worked well, where the international actors have been invited in, where they've been equal partners? And if not, is there one of the cases in the past, one of the countries in the past, where you've mentioned, like Sierra Leone, if they had done it differently, you know, there wouldn't have been some of the harmful effects later on? So what may have that looked like, knowing maybe what the countries would have wanted, what that might have looked like?
Okay, and we have...
thank you. Two very brief questions. My first one follows up from the previous point. Susan, you ended your presentation by saying you're not necessarily against aid or intervention. I'm just wondering, under what circumstances would you be in favor? I know this is maybe an impossible question, but I thought I'd put it to you. My second question refers to how you just cited the example of Syria, and I refer people, there's a fascinating article in the latest issue of The Spectator that very convincingly argues, I think, that Putin's intervention in Syria has been very successful, unlike the hash that the West has made, and in fact, despicably even aiding ISIS in attempts to unseat Assad. And by contrast, Putin's intervention has been a success. And I just wondered why that is. Some of the operational conditions that you mentioned, actually, I think might point to the reasons that they're satisfied. Putin was invited by a sovereign government. It had certain administrative capacity. And contrary to what the Western press argues, the majority of the Syrian people actually support Assad. I just wondered whether you had any comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to admit that this question of whether I think it should all, you know, I really don't, that's not the critique I want to make. But I also think people are going to continue to aid in some way or another, so it's sort of even more fruitless than that to ask them to stop using the term failed states. But also, what would shake it up, I think, to me, while I was writing the book, the idea that what was really happening was these organizations building their own capacities rather than doing what they say they were doing. And secondly, that when they got criticism, they'd say, oh, well, it's just we didn't have enough capacity or resources. I was really struck as I listened to Well, let's say UN people or American politicians at a place like the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, where you get people who are fairly high level in terms of how they've risen in their organizations. And that's exactly what they keep saying. Well, we didn't have enough. We need more. And I thought this was a good idea, but now it's really true of all these. So why do I say that? I think whether it's logics at play, as you say, I do worry that these organizations, all of them, are now so institutionalized with all these new capacities built from the early mid-90s that it's hard to imagine them changing. Now, you mentioned the Chinese. As Christine knows, and Denise too, in the book I say at the end, when I come back to saying this is I need a systemic perspective on all of these actors, that it is the international system and how it's working and how each plays within it, refer to a book that's very highly regarded by an American international relations scholar, John Eikenberry, and it's called After Victory. And some of you may know it. His argument is that after any major war, the victor or victors create a system that is stable after the war, the major wars, world wars, if the victor builds in institutions that check the power of the victor so that those who are subordinate to the victor feel that they are, you know, they're not just being dominated and that they're safe. And Eikenberry's argument is that that's what the United States did with the United Nations, with World Bank, with IMF, and with NATO, that it did build institutions that in some ways constrained American power so other people felt safe and work within it. He also argues in a book in 2003 that these U.S.-led built institutions were still playing the stabilizing role of the international system that they did during the Cold War. Well, to me, it doesn't look very stable. But more importantly, I am coming to China, I'm taking a little while to say this, but that what we forget, and certainly I can very forget, is that there were two stabilizing components for the Cold War. One are these Western institutions, and the other was the rivalry between East and West, the U.S. and the Soviet Union and their allies. Why was that stabilizing? In my view, because the rivalry allowed states to have more policy space. Not go the Peter Bauer way, but to be able to say, well, you know, if we don't like the U.S. liberal hegemony, maybe we can go to Soviet planning or whatever, like Turkey or India. And so there was more competition over ideas and interveners in that period that I think was a stabilizing mechanism. So at the end I say, well, so what's going to produce this competition now? And we are beginning to see the beginnings through China with its infrastructure bank and with its statement, as I quote them at the beginning, we don't talk about failure, we talk about development. Now, one may not like the way they do development, but at least they're focusing on development. So I can see the beginnings of this, but, you know, who knows what China will do and how much that'll organize around people. And I don't have much hope for it, but I think that I'm looking for sources of competition that might give more space. I don't have any cases that worked well. I mean, there are some that people studied where there weren't interveners. There's a wonderful study of the role that countries have in negotiating aid with development donors, done by Whitfield and her team at Oxford a couple of years ago. And they, I think it was nine countries, I'm forgetting, the three countries that were very successful in negotiating aid were Ethiopia, Rwanda, and Botswana. Rwanda is a special case and won't last in terms of the strength and ability to get its own terms and negotiate. But Ethiopia and Botswana is because they're very strong parties, very strong ideologies, very strong leaders. On a political sense, you might call it very strong states, and they were successful. But that was not intervention then, so of the kind that I'm talking about. So I, you know, and the second half of your question requires a counterfactual analysis that I'm just not up to doing. One other thing. As aid effectiveness debates continued and donors were beginning to see sort of early, mid 21st century, between, let's say, 2004 and 2008, beginning to address again, they did it in the late 90s as well, why their aid isn't more effective, you got more and more, forgetting what the term is, where donors and governments would work together. So all of a sudden it's not recipients and donors, it's one group and they're all planning. Now, the power relationship in that situation is that still the donors are going to define things. But this idea that you're getting more and more, in many cases, I think of Mozambique as a good example, though I certainly don't think the outcomes are good on the economic side, where it's hard to distinguish which, the two sides are sort of managing the country itself. But I wish I had a better answer. Okay, Laza, I am in favor of aid if we could figure out how to do it better. I'm not a Dambisa Moyo or a Bill, what's his name at NYU. Now, Easterly, thanks, Christine. That's not my position, but I admit that once I got all the facts that I had available to me on the ground, it looks pretty depressing. But this issue about Putin and Syria, I like very much the way you're saying that the three operational criteria seem to be available to Putin or the Russians. One of the things that I say, again, it has to do with the structure of the international system after the Cold War, is the organizations on the Western side didn't change, and they are now sort of dominant. But contrary to what IR scholars like Martha Finnemore say, that the two criteria of international order and the purposes of intervention are one, a particular model, consensus model among the major powers and their allies of what kind of political system will be stable and be order in liberal democracy at the moment. And the other is multilateralism. And I'm saying that the irony is that multilateralism no longer exists. In all of my actors in this book are all pursuing their national interests. There's no longer that glue that among Western powers and states had of anti-communism, of the Western alliance, to act together. So now, whether it's Sweden or France or Germany or Italy, in each of these countries, they're all only pursuing their national interests. So whether that's equivalent to the geopolitical considerations that Russia is making in Syria, I'd have to think further, but it doesn't really look any different than what other countries are doing, it would seem to me.
Shall we do another round of questions? Mm-hmm. Okay, so, quite a few.
I'll try to be.
Yeah, let's take four this time. So we had here, yeah.
Hi, I was going to ask about Ian Lustig. He's looked at failed states and says that essentially the incentive is for Western governments to maintain failed states in order to prevent state formation, which then would pose a threat, particularly in areas like the Middle East. In that sense, then, apart from reforming the aid system, what would you, and the fact that it seems to be fighting against what Ian Lustig is talking about, what alternative would you suggest?
Okay, the question over the young lady there.
Hi, should I just stand up so you can see me? Sorry, thanks. Please. For the talk. I'd like to take your idea a step further. You talk about the ideology of failed states. Well, what about the ideology of failed nations? Because this past 70 years has only ever seen the acceptance of one political system, the nation state. And that, you know, when you talk about states, you're not talking about any political institution. You're talking about a political institution that has a conception of a nation. And the thing is, most nations in the global south are nothing like the nations here. Like, for example, you know, India was mentioned. India has nearly 25 national languages. Can you imagine a country like the UK have 25 national languages? I mean, how can this contribute to your question? Thanks.
Okay, and shall we take very quickly just two here, and then I remembered you, and you were there.
Is
if we had time.
Who wants very much to?
And that one, okay. So we'll wrap up with those three, okay? So, yes, so here. Yeah, these. And behind.
What strategies can international actors use to streamline their aid to make it most effective? If you're saying that we need to listen to local actors, which ones do we listen to if they're competing for acceptance within the state?
Okay, if you could just pass the mic. Yeah.
What sort of solutions would you propose to solve the complete overdependency that a lot of countries, your example being Haiti, have on international aid and the industries that have formed in, like, chauffeurs and translators around international aid?
Thank you so much for your talk, Susan. So I'm a PhD candidate at King's with the Law Department, and my research is also looking at international donors and their intervention on judicial independence projects in East Timor. So from my research, what I see is that usually the mandates of these donors, as well as how they understand the different attributes of what constitutes to be an independent judiciary, is usually based on which country that these donors are based from. Yeah. And a lot of these interventions are based on the assumptions that they carry from the host donor nations. So similarly with the failed states, this goes back to this ideology of how we conceptualize failed states. Do you think that the interventions fail because of the failure of the donors in identifying the right attributes, because these donors come from a particular, they come with their presumptions of a Westphalian state, and they are trying to define the failure of a state according to those attributes, and the interventions are directed accordingly. Thank you.
Shall we take two more, so you have all of them, and then we'll, all right, so there and... Yes, the lady there and that.
So thank you very much for the presentation and discussion. I'll try to be very, very short. I won't be like any defender of any international organizations, but I think some of the facts and some of the underlying theses that you brought, they're a little bit like from a bit older, because like a lot of institutions, they have adopted and they have changed their policies. So my question is basically whatever already was mentioned, so what are your recommendations? I haven't heard like what would you recommend, how should the aid organization go forward? And a very specific question, you mentioned about like salaries in a local, like for example NGOs and donors, they pay higher salaries and they actually extract nationals from the government entities to work in the offices. What would be your solution? How can we stop this? This is a very particular question. Thank you.
Okay, Susan, you have two burning questions, two more. But I won't take it any more afterwards, okay? So, but I think there are some themes emerging. So, a young lady there, you had a question, and lady there as well, yes?
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. My question is regarding to failed states could be a concept, as you discuss in your book, that has been used as an ideology. And I'm wondering about the new one that's permeating in the United Nations, that's the sustaining peace concept, that basically is calling for prevention. And although it takes the action within the states and claims that states have to develop in order to avoid conflict, it does consider some intervention. Like, how can this sustaining peace concept be explained in this context?
Okay, and the last question over there.
Thank you. That was a really fascinating introduction. I think you're definitely onto something about ideology, and my question really is about that, you know, and how do new ideologies come about? I think there is one thing in common between the old colonialism and what this new form of interventionism, if we want to call it that, at the core of both of them is a negation of sovereignty. That's what they both depend on. The right to intervene assumes the absence of real sovereignty. And whereas under the old imperialism, that was couched in thoroughly, openly racist terms, that these weren't nations, they're children, that they need to be civilized and educated and so on. That's obviously not the terminology of this new kind of moral interventionism that we've seen. It's much more about playing a therapeutic role. I wanted to just ask if you looked at the period immediately of the early 90s, because you talked about how this ideology really started to develop from the mid-1990s. And if you think back to that early period, which looking at Eastern Europe, which I looked at a lot, around the time of the Washington Consensus, actually the consensus was about the retreat of the state, triumphalism, free market economics. The state only started to come back in the World Bank's, you know, reports and so on, around that time, 93, 94. So in terms of how this, you know, how a whole justification for this much more extensive intervention came about, I think it took some time, and, you know, ideologies don't just spring, you know, out of the ground just like that. It takes time, and this has been germinating for quite a long time. So I'm just wondering if, you know, you looked at that early period and of the straight after the collapse of the Berlin Wall.
Just to be able to manage this.
Yes, Susan, we don't have time, yes. Much time to go into those. Yeah.
So I'll start with it actually starts in the early 90s, and for the World Bank, it's 1989 with the Africa Report. So I've already, that's, you know, what I'm looking at. I like the idea that this comparison between new interventionism and colonialism is the negation of sovereignty. I'll think about that. Several of you, the question about Ian Lustig's work on the Middle East, wanting alternatives, somebody wanting solutions to dependency. I'll come back to that. You want recommendations? I'm not in the business of doing that right now. I'm just having to document what's going on, and then maybe the next day. It is true. I had a fascinating conversation with a different person today where they're saying, not in terms of the UN sustaining peace concept, but needing a new paradigm for what's going on. So that's, I really invite all of you to think about it, because some of you have already, in these last series of eight questions, still talk about failed states as if you accept the term. My whole point of the book is to say, please stop using it and don't use it. So think about what might be an alternative. I happen to think that we need to accept what Aude Westad tells us, that what we used to call the Third World was increasingly differentiated internally by the early 80s already, and what we're doing with this concept is pushing them all back into one category, and that's very, very pernicious. So now, on Lustig, I think the incentive to maintain failed states is a state policy. It's not the policy of these individual actors, so I wouldn't compare it. In terms of the salaries, you know, Lakhdar Brahimi tried very hard when he went in to be the head of the mission in Afghanistan at the end of 2001, had this idea of a light footprint. And by light footprint, he meant exactly that, that Afghans should be employed and salaries should be low. That did not survive the donor conference of the next January. So, yeah, terrible. And friends of mine at the UN really wanted very much to try and implement that, and they failed. I think what you've said about East Timor is, I have a lot to say along the same lines in the book, so I'm more or less just supporting what you're saying. Strategies to streamline. I think the only thing to say in this regard, because again, this is the kind of recommendations I'm not yet prepared to make, nor do I think I may ever be, but I'm certainly going to think about it, is that there would be lots of easy ways. I have a colleague in the room, I won't embarrass him by giving his name, who always works very well with locals and knows how to work well with locals when you go in this case, for example, a peace building mission. And everyone I know has, I mean, locals have lots of good ideas. I'm not saying they're going to have one idea. They're going to disagree. So it's not like finding one local. But the number, the extent to which we ignore what local actors say in terms of what kind of development strategy they want, what kind of ways of creating a community that could be peaceful. I mean, we can go on and on and on. It's really quite shocking. Amos Sawyer, one of my favorite people, who is, and you know him, who was the interim president between the peace agreement in Liberia and the first elections, says, was pushing very hard for the UN to delay elections because it said the problem with Liberia is its 1890s, whenever it's the last decade of the 19th century, constitution, which gives all power, especially over property and landed property, to the president. And there's no point in having elections and just reproducing the same political system. We need a discussion about constitutional reform first. The UN wouldn't allow that. And lo and behold, the president, who has now had two terms, she went ahead and did all the things that he was worried about, of kicking off hundreds of thousands of Liberian farmers from the land that she was then handing to multinational corporations. So I think that there are lots of ways that we could do more to listen to locals. My favorite part is, you know, when the UN and the World Bank largely, and sometimes development donors, go in after a peace agreement with what's called a joint assessment mission, a JAM, to identify what the needs of the country are so you can design a national development strategy. But what do they look at? They look at what they, the outsiders, think is missing. Whereas Amos says, why don't you look first and see what local capacities do exist and build on that? So just to give another idea, I think, just quickly on nation states, from the woman from India. I'm a specialist on Yugoslavia. It wasn't a nation state. Most of the countries in the world are not nation states. This is, I don't know who, what political scientist, it's probably an American, who uses this term all as if that, no, I think multinational states and are, we know the more stable from Fearon and Leighton. And what is causing this new move towards secession, whether you're talking about Kosovo or Catalonia or the Kurds or something, is, I think, very much a worth studying. I mean, it's part of what Ian Lustig looks at, but it's not what I did in this book.
Susan, thank you very much for all your thoughts and comments, and to you for your questions. We look forward to what comes next. And I just want to say that we have flyers for 20% discount from CUP if you would like to pick up on your way out when you go and buy the book.